Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I just thank you and Julian for the very brief introduction, and also the organizers and Sales Institute for inviting me here. To start out with, I think I should give a little bit background story on why I do this study. As a long-time mother, I was asked by Taiwan CDC in 2005 to do some modeling study of vaccine policy in Taiwan for influenza. That was during the avian flu scare. And I was promised, actually, by the Taiwan CDC director at that time, that I will have full access to all the data available in Taiwan CDC regarding influenza. And he was very good with his work. Actually, I had 99%. The 1% was entirely not his fault. Okay, it was just something that. And so I had a lot of data. But in a way, it's a mother's dream, right? You know, you can get any data you want, even the case data, okay, individual case data. However, the more I look into it, the more confused I got. Okay. Let me try this one. Okay. See, at that time there was several sets of surveillance data in Taiwan. There was a standard ILI data, there was the severe influenza data, the sentinel doctor surveillance, and actually in 2005, it was added, they established a new syndromic surveillance data. The purpose was try to capture emerging cases immediately. Now, each has its problem, of course. We know ILI always overestimates because it's got a lot of cases that had nothing to do with influenza. And the severe influenza data usually is confirmed clinically by doctors or by lab tests, which are more reliable. However, you know, it's been telling several talks the other day, it's a matter of denominator. Who gets tested? It's only those people that have severe cases. So what happened that if when I look at the data, it's heavily skewed toward the older people, because older people tend to have more severe, you know, needing hospitalization, and they get tested. Okay, so it's very biased. And of course, the sentinel doctor surveillance are the ones that the medical seasonal medical doctors spread all over Taiwan, and they report their clinical cases. So it's sort of sampling. And also the syndromic surveillance, it's a network of hospitals and clinics where they will report the syndromic cases that they feel that will be influenza. Some of them, like for the larger hospital, they actually test themselves. Okay. So, but still, you know, it's a sort of sampling. And then we also have the standard influenza data. You have the case data, the lab confirmed case data, the hospitalization, mortality, and so on. And if you put them all together and compare, they look very different. Okay. It's very difficult to do. And at the end, actually, what I did was I used the mortality data. Okay. So, because one thing, you know, 95% of them were lab confirmed. And, you know, when the death happened that has symptoms of ILI symptoms, you know, usually it's reported, okay? So you capture most of this data. And, of course, there's also a problem because mortality happened mostly in elderly and young children. So, again, it's heavily biased, okay? So there are problems in that also. So I started thinking about this problem. It seems to be very, very common problem everywhere. So when I moved from one university in the math department to public health department of medical university, one of the things I wanted to try was, can I, based on our need as modelers, try to design and to carry out a study where we can have a better idea of how, during the outbreak, you know, the actual infections that had occurred. Okay, so I was innocent enough to to try to do something I was not familiar with. But I had a lot of colleagues because there I have, there were epidemiologists, statistician, biostatistician, medical doctors, sociologists. So I was able to, with help of a couple of other senior colleagues, form a group of about 1,000 people and try to do it. And we proposed a three-year longitudinal serial FB study in central Taiwan. And we also spent a time trying to get money to do that. Okay. And so what we had, starting the fall of 2008, we recruited 306 persons from 104 households with school children. So what we did was I went into elementary school and sent out forms asking the parents of the student if they are willing for the whole family to enter into this study. And we did it so that we have a sufficient number that's in the urban city, Taichung City, where I work, and also one rural county next to Taichung City in Nantou. And in the September of 2009, as we now know, you know, this is our first year study. At the end of first year, 2009 H1N1 emerged. So we quickly expanded our study to include, because before it was mainly with seasonal flu, and we expanded to include the novel H1N1. So we recruited additional set of people also. So we have even larger study. Okay, now just to show, this is Taiwan, okay, and here is Taichung City, where I am, and my university is here. So we recruited from elementary school in that district. And also Nantou is here. It's the only county in Taiwan that's completely inland. It's not, it's not next to the, it's nowhere next to the ocean. And these are the three townships. Now, for the first year, 2008, we only recruited subjects from this county. They are actually connected by Taichung by highway, so it's 30 minutes away. Okay, so it's rural town, but the population in Taiwan is 1 million, and the population for this county and city is between 100,000 to 300,000, so it's a medium size. And even next year, we purposely try to recruit subjects from this township here. Okay, this township is very small and it's more remote, it's more mountainous. And it takes 30 minutes to 60 minutes to get from here to here. Okay, so it's a remote place. So as you can see, we try to look at things not only from urban and rural, but urban in terms of difference. It's part of the idea I got from one of Julian's talk when they were looking at Canada, big city, and they would drive an hour, you're getting to a small town, right? Yeah. And we don't have that distinction, but you know, we try to have a sort of three layers sort of different to look at the spread. Okay. Now, what we did is we had pre-season post-season questionnaires on the contact patterns, contact frequency in the different settings. And we also asked them to keep weekly family diaries of symptoms during the flu season, and bi-weekly we will make calls just to make sure that, you know, everything's been done. And probably more importantly, we also take serum samples before and after influenza season for their HI assay against H1N1 viruses of seasonal flu, the circulating widespread flu, as well as PH1N1. Okay, I should add that we also did for H3NB, but for the purpose of this study, of course, you know, they are less consequential. Okay, because one of the things that we want to look at is actually the connection between PH1N1 and the circulating and the vaccine strains of H1N1. Okay, and how they might be related. And I should add that the immunization program for Taiwan is, for PH1N1 started in November 1st. And by the end of the campaign, over 5 million people were immunized. And the children under 8 were supposed to get 2 doses. Everybody else 1 dose. But a lot of those children did not get the second dosage. For various reasons. And this is a quick timeline of the study. So So we start actually October 2008. So this is our first sampling, the second sampling, and this is the third sampling in the fall of 2009, between September and November of last year. Okay, and then we continue for this. This is after vaccination. Okay, we did it in December, from December to actually January. But it's only for school children only, because school children had very high vaccination rate for PHR1, over 90%, national total. Okay, and also this. So these are the five sampling that we have already done. Okay, actually next month we're starting the third year, the first sampling for the third year. Now, what I'm going to talk today is mainly results from the first three sampling. Test something. Okay, I'm going to have a little bit result on this also, but mostly on this. Part reason is the time. As I said, you know, we expanded right around June, around June, July of last year. So we had to do it quickly. And so it turned out to be an extra burden on the resources, manpower, and everything. And we were a little bit overwhelmed by that. So we're a little bit behind. So we have the result of all this, and this the result here is it's being done right now. I mean, it should supposed to be finished by before the end of this month. All the test results for the against the three strains. If we need the HI title for all to make the comparison. Okay, now a little bit about the because I'm going to talk about this, so I give you a little bit. A lot of you are probably familiar with that, but you know, I'll just make sure that what we're talking about. Now we're going to look at HI titer for presence of antibody in the human beings, and the titer of 10 implies that the detectable level of immune response in an individual are increased by a factor of 2. So you see titers of 10, 20. Oh, this is typo. 40. Okay. We all know how to multiply 2, right? Okay, 40, 80, and 160, 320, and so on. Okay. And why is it to have protection if a person has a HI titer of 40 or above? It's called cerebral protection. And then infection may occur if you notice a fourfold increase in HI titer between two samples. Okay, but you know all these are not exact science. Okay, but they are generally, if you look at literature, that's what's being used. But there are also ample literature that say that these are not the best choice. For example, there are papers showing that one could also very easily get infected if with a titer of above 40, and this it's even more problematic with the infection, because a lot of things could happen with individuals. You know, some people who get the fourfold increase after vaccination, especially people with very low titer, you know, or non-detectable. And some people have a strong response to immunology. And on the other hand, you know, for people who might have had a high titer before, they might get infected, okay, but without a fourfold increase. So you know, either way is possible. There's always some problem. That's why I said, you know, I try to do this all this, and I found out that you know I might have tried to attempt to solve some problem. But there are new problems arising. Okay, I mean that's life, right? Okay, and also we'll have the GMT, which is geometric mean titer for group or individual. It shows the group protection or immune response. Okay. This is the first table that we have. Here are some demographic information, and we also have vaccination rate. Okay. And as you can see, that the vaccine rate for children for 5 to 18 is very high, mainly with school children. As I said, after 2000 and in starting 2007, thank you. Starting 2007, students from year 1 and year 2 are tested freely, and 2008 was expanded to 1 to 4. Okay, so you can see an increasing vaccination rate for this group. While this is both high low, and for elderly, even though they have free vaccination, but it's usually not high. You know, the national total is around about 50%, a little bit over. Okay, now here is the seroconversion. Okay, the fourfold increase. Now, the interesting is I want to look at sample two versus sample one. That means the fourfold increase between the first and second sample. Remember, the first sample was for the fall of 2008. The second one is spring of 2009, from April to June. Okay. So what we've shown that is that there's a significant number of people who have shown fourfold increase in for PH1-1 by April to June. Okay. Now, we had this result at the end of last year, actually. Okay. And the person in charge of this, our resident expert molecular epidemiologist, she was very cautious. So actually, she redoed the whole testing again with almost the same result. But you know, there's a delay and all that. So by the time we try to publish it, we run into some problem. Okay. Of course, there are some a legitimate question whether there are cross reaction with other strains. But you see, in the bracket, I show the number of people who had no fourfold increase for any of these others, including the virus strain and the vaccine strain. So those people are most likely, say, they were tested without any antibody immune response for any other strain except PH1-1. Okay? So it came down to about 9.10%. So by April, June of 2009, okay, in our study subjects, about 10% people already had fourfold increase from the fall of the year before to that. Okay, very interesting. And of course, if we look at from the second to third, this is from April, June of 2009 to September, October 2009. So the period in between was a summer outbreak, right? And we have a significant larger number of increase. If you look at that, you know, if you put 9% and that's almost 50%. Okay. And one thing that that people also asked was that, well, you know, it seems to be same for different age group, right? It's very similar. Okay. Now the standard knowledge is that for children is higher, right? I think that it was given several times, it's like that. For children is higher, and then adults and elderly even. One explanation I could give is that this adult subject are biased because they all have school children in their family, right? We recruited from the school children. It's a school children-based household, okay? So in one way, one could look at it as a sort of indication of importance of the role of school children in household transmission, okay? Well, there's a lot we can look at. Okay, I give. Okay, this is the time course of what we're talking about now. This is the WHO stages 4, 5, and 6. And this is the first confirmed imported case in Taiwan. Okay, imported case from North America. Okay, and if we look at this is the black blocks are those that were tested to have HI titer of greater than or equal to 10. Okay, so see, this is the end of March, beginning of April, and here we have mid-April. We already have a lot of people with HR titer greater than 10, greater equal than 10. Okay, so a lot of people now. Remember, this is before we know about PHN1, right? It wasn't at the end of April that we know about that. Okay, so. Our proposal is that almost 1 in 10 persons in our cohort group has been infected by the time of April, June. Okay. And it was that the implication is that the pandemic virus spread globally much earlier than imported cases being detected by the system, because in Taiwan it was in late May that we have the first case. But in April we already have all this cases with a positive serologic test. And some of you might know, in a recent paper in PLOS One, a group in Australia, they used modeling and the data from starting from June in Victoria to propose that the early case in Australia started in April. Okay, but ours is serologic evidence. Okay, I should move quickly. So I just, this is the, to touch on, this is another paper in preparation by a social economic epidemiologist in our group, and try to compare urban and rural. And as you see that there's a little different almost everywhere except here and here. Okay, and in terms of their context and their family structure and that, so there is a significant difference in that. And now, the next question is that, well, what does it have to do with infection? Okay, and here is some result we have, and we divide into for age less than equal to 12 and greater than equal to 12, so because these are the school children group, and these are the adults in the family. Now, let me just show whatever in red are the ones that we found to be significant, which means that here, during the first or second sampling, there's nothing really different, but there is significant here. So what it means that if you look at that, the infection or incidence between rural and urban early on was almost the same, but during summer it changed. This is much larger, okay, in attack rate as well as the positive rate. Okay, now for the adults, the attack rate is also different. Okay, so there is some impact of this difference in rural and urban in terms of the resulting infection. Okay, well, of course there might be a host of other reasons that we've talked about, for example, travel rates, different travel rates and so on. Okay, now this is another work. Okay, I didn't show the details, but I just give you some results, because there are some question being asked also of the impact of seasonal food. What we found was that when you have had a person has seasonal flu vaccine and it result in the HI titer of 40 or above in terms of immune response after vaccination, you have partial protection. That means there is some statistical significance, but not very strong. But the strongest statistical significant protection occur when you have been previously infected by DHN1. Okay, it makes sense, right? Okay, it's a little simplification of results, but I'll give that, because this is also something under review now with EID. So hopefully we'll see more of it. And okay, this is the added part with the full sampling. Okay, that's where we test the school children. Okay, a month after they had vaccination for PHN1. Okay, now let's see. So they are all total, and we divide into grade 1, 2, 3, 4, and 6, because there is a difference. Okay, as you can see, that for older children, it's always greater. There's a greater conversion, zero conversion rate, greater GMT ratio. That means an increase of that. You know, increase of 2.5 means there's a significant increase in the GMT. And also, if we look at the seroprotection rate, you know, titer greater than or equal to 40, before and after the one dose of vaccination, before it was greater here, less than here. Okay? Now, afterward, it's still greater, but it's much closer. So, if you look at the difference, it seems that the difference of vaccination made a larger impact here. Of course, we have to test this against the fourfold increase, because as I said again, you know, there might be infection occurring. Okay, although the two sampling was relatively close, because there were like 2 or 3 months between. But those were the months, as you will see later, was where we had the peak of PHN1 fall winter wave in Taiwan. And the seroprotection against the wild type seasonal flu was 48%. Okay, so it seems that the PHN1 is actually pretty efficacious in terms of against PHN1. Okay, some of the things that from what we look at and how we can think of in terms of modeling. One is actually a problem, as I said, we're working on now, because we are obtaining the last sample from early April of last year, of this year. Okay, so we're trying to compare the three sets, okay, before season, after vaccination, and after season. and try to look at how seasonal flu vaccine and 2009 vaccine interplays. And as all of you know, there are some different opinion in that regard. And there also the problem of when we ask for effectiveness of a vaccine, it always comes with other things that were going on, other interventions that were going on, especially the non-pharmaceutical intervention. And so in Taiwan, we had a very unique 3-to-5 class suspension policy in Taiwan, where a mandatory 3-to-5 policy was implemented for kindergarten to secondary school, cram school, Chinese society special, after school institution and so on. And 3-to-5 means that if within any 3 days, there are two or more students in the same class diagnosed to have contracted influenza. Usually that's by clinical diagnosis, quick test or whatever. Then the class, that class alone is suspended for the next 5 days. Okay, the rest of the school is not effective. Okay, and there was a lot of those. Okay, it came down to about 1.4% of all classes and school have been suspended. But luckily, both of my boys, one in grade 10, the other in grade 7, they both were the lucky 1.4%. Okay, so. Okay, now I should mention that it's obvious the aim is to minimize the social impact of school closing, and which that in that respect it was successful. Okay, because only the parents of the student were allowed to have days off with pay. Okay, but it didn't affect me. Okay, I still work, and they just say, they're big enough, so they stay at home and do what they want. Okay. But it had very, very little social impact now. And of course, one can ask, does it have any impact in terms of the outbreak? Okay. Now, I'll get to that a little bit later. Okay. And there's also spatial spread. Okay. It's something that when we start working on the urban-rural difference in our studies, and that's what we want to look at. And of course, it's not so easy to do. And then there's the contact matrix. Because we in our questionnaire we also ask for contact frequency, so we have a contact frequency of that. But there are some problems. For one, we know it's biased toward children, right? Because every family has children, so the adults in the group have more contact with children than normal, right? Okay, so that's one problem. And also, but if you look at between urban and rural, there's a lot of difference. So the contact matrix are different. And we're trying to, this is something also we're working on with the help of statistician. We're trying to adjust it, to adjust to the bias caused by children-based households. Okay, so there's several projects we're working on. Okay, and of course there's a cost-benefit problem because it's always asked, and I was asked by a lot of colleagues. In Taiwan to look into that, and as one can see, when you look at the cost benefit analysis for vaccination or for 3-to-5 school closing, it's not so easy to do because we also have a priority of 12 group, right? So with the timing schedule of that, how do you put it into the model? Okay, that's a very difficult situation. And also for the school closing, we don't have school closing, we have class suspension. So how do you model that? Okay, I have some colleagues that are thinking about using network model. Okay, because using agent-based model might be a better way than a compartmental model. Okay, just 3 more minutes. Okay, this is what I did with using a very simple research model to fit Taiwan's data, and we found that it fits a two-wave data, which is obvious because the first wave, this is again typo, this is June, okay, this is June 3rd to September. So we have two waves. First wave is June, August, early September, and this is the second wave. And I use two different set of data, weekly hospitalization and daily hospitalization data, and they come out similar. So what you have here is about 1.4 something in mean and the range is 1.1 to 1.8. Okay. Now, in another work, we are looking at 6,000 hemisphere countries and also using different sets of government data, okay, including death data and so on. Actually, I'm fitting the same methodology, research model. I get very similar things here. Okay, it's also, if you look at it, it's also about from 1.1 to 1.8. Okay, so it seems that at least we know from using the same methodology, the summer wave in Taiwan was similar in transmissibility to the southern hemisphere outbreaks that was occurring at the same time, right, in June, July. Okay, very similar. But in the second wave, in the fourth wave, it's much lower. Okay, the mean is about 1.08, and range is 1.05 to 1.1 something. Okay, because we have much longer outbreak here and a lot more data, so the 95% confidence was much smaller, much less variant. Now the interesting thing is that it shows that because in recent model the R, okay. We can think about this R0 because this is closer to R0, right? This is sort of beginning of that, even if we have some infection before June. But this is R. This is after things have been going on a while. Now, in research model, what we estimate is actually using the initial growth rate. So it's sort of the reproduction number at the beginning of this wave. So we can look at this as the reproduction number around July, and this is the one that in September, October. Now, why is there such a big difference? If we look at this 1.4, 1.5 something. Now, remember, in our cohort group, there was about 50% conversion rate, right? By the end of the second wave in September, October. But it might be an overestimate, as I said, because there's the adults all have interaction in household with children, okay, which is not true for any adult. Okay, so there's an overestimate for that. Now, my colleagues in Hong Kong say that they estimate that in Hong Kong, by September, October, there were about 30% of people have been infected, or at least have the antibody for PHN1. So if we think about the situation, if it's similar in Taiwan, okay, we have 30% pre-immunity by the fall and outbreak. And if you look at this is 1.4 something, more than 1.5, and you reduce it by 30%, what do you get? 1.0 something. Okay, so I think it makes sense. So what it means is that by this time, there's pre-immunity setting, and R is already very low. And my conjecture is that's what happened in North America also. Okay, then the next question is that given that if you have a low R value of 1.0 something or 1.1, how much vaccination do you need? How much intervention do you need? Okay, I think that's an interesting question for models. Okay, and this is potentials. Okay, I just put this one last thing is that, see, this is school open, so this is the end of first wave and beginning of second wave. Now, mass immunization is this time. In this recent model, we can estimate the so-called turning point, which in this week, several speakers have talked about in terms of the time of maximum peak of infection. Okay, it's essentially the same thing. So it's peaking around this time. That means that after a while, it's going down, right? Now, it's going down like a little more than a week or 2 weeks after the mass immunization starts. And we know that from this week's discussion that it takes 2 to 4 weeks for vaccination to take into effect. So the outbreak has started to go down before immunization had any effect. Okay. Then of course next question is that did it help to keep it down? Okay. And that's also something for mothers to think about. Okay. Oh, I forgot. I put in this last night, okay, after Zilan's talk and discussions on comparing and looking at different sets of data, right? Now, this is something by another work, okay, by a statistician colleagues of ours, and where he used the Mount Parametric Maximum Likelihood Estimate to estimate the cumulative infection rate. But this is, his language, okay, it's like cumulative incidence rate. Okay, so it goes from here and goes up from early. When we, here is where we have the first sampling for the second sampling period. And then these are the positive fourfold increases, and it goes up like that, right? Okay, now, this curve is what I got by fitting hospitalization number, okay, to Richard's model. Okay, now these are two completely different sets, right? This is the incidence rate, okay, and this is number of hospitalizations. But if you look at that, you know, I could swear that this is sort of a step function estimate of this curve, right? The point is, I think that it shows that there is some correlation between different kinds of data. They are all different, but there is some correlation. Okay, and in this case, both show similar trend, increasing trend, because both are cumulative numbers, or cumulative number or cumulative rate. Okay, but their increasing trend is exactly the same. Okay, here are some acknowledgments for funding and collaborators, and thank you very much. And that's about this, a little advertisement, because we need manpower as well as everything else. Thank you very much.